Hey everyone, it's March 24th, 2019, and this is your episode 176 of At Percussion. My name is Casey Cangelosi, and with me as usual are my co-host Megan Arnes.
Hello.
And Carly Vinas here.
Yes, sir.
Hi everyone.
And Ben Charles, how's it going?
Hey everybody, doing well.
So I thought I'd start today, before we introduce John, just talking a little about the recent news, because, of course, we all teach at colleges and have attended colleges and universities and all that sort of thing. But have you guys checked out the recent college bribery scandal that came to light?
Yeah, it's all over the news. It's crazy.
Are you guys just enjoying it like I am, or do you think it's really tragic and sad?
I really wasn't surprised at all.
I know, right? It's like the least surprising thing in the world. I think what's surprising about it is the, what's the right word? Just like the, just how nonchalant they are about it. So one of the celebrities, and of course, you know, of course they're picking on the celebrities like crazy, but one of the celebrities, I believe it's the actress from Full House, it's Lori Loughlin. She has a correspondence, an email with one of her, with who they're calling a corroborating witness. She says, "Rutrow, looks like my daughter's high school wants to provide their own proctor." So it's like, they're being that cavalier about it, which makes it, I don't know, extremely upsetting. Like, Rutrow, really? Rutrow? How you all are doing this? Like, that's how...
Yeah.
I don't know, casual it is. So if you're not hip to this story, about 50 people are getting charged with basically criminal racketeering. It's going to be a criminal RICO case, which is like the giant conspiracy criminal charge. And about 50 people, coaches, parents, school administrators at schools like Yale, where else? Yale, USC, the University of Texas, Stanford, UCLA, Wake Forest, and Georgetown. They're all wrapped up in this giant cheating scam orchestrated by a guy named William Singer, who has been running this nonprofit charity for years called The Key. And The Key, quote's mission is to provide guidance, encouragement, and opportunity to disadvantaged students around the world. So he's taking these giant bribes from parents to then pay off test givers, as in like the ACT and SAT. He'll have people either take the test for these students, or he'll pay off the graders to change answers, or they'll pay off doctors to write disability notes to give the kids extra time. They even went so far as to Photoshop pictures of the kids playing sports and then bribe college coaches to accept them onto the teams, even though they don't play that sport at all. So I guess Lori Loughlin's daughter got accepted to the rowing crew team at USC, even though she doesn't do that at all. So that's kind of the gist of it.
Well, one of the things that I thought was really interesting about this is everybody either seemed really surprised or not really surprised at all that college admissions would be influenced so much by wealth. And I stumbled upon an NPR article that talked about how college admissions really work in the college admissions scandal. And it said, if the admission scandal shocked you, read this. So they're talking about, like direct donations to schools or legacy admissions. Like that's no secret. And that's perfectly legal and 100%, acceptable. And common, I think. But even things like test prep that some students have access to, or really legitimate college counseling and college, kind of preparation. And also like campus visits, if you go and show interest that you visit the college. So what I started to think about were all the ways that this applies to music. And of course, I haven't heard anything about this particular scandal involving music schools the way that it's involving sports teams and athletics. But there's still so many ways that students who have the means and have the kind of inside knowledge are advantaged, like taking private lessons. Of course, that's the most obvious one. But also having access to like youth orchestra programs, or even the quality of their school music program, or if they even have a school music program, which is just part of where you live and the way that the local government splits up the funds, buying sticks and mallets and music. We all know that's a ton of money.
Yeah.
And then also kind of just having the luxury of like dreaming big and thinking I'm going to have a career in the arts and it might work out to be really lucrative right away, or it might take a long time. I might spend 5 years in grad school like many of us do. You know, so there are so many factors, and it's not that we never see students that don't come from at least middle class or wealthy backgrounds in music, but it takes a lot to get in.
Yeah, for sure. And I think what's interesting about this one is a lot of the reports are saying, what happened to the good old days where you just bought a library to get your kid in, you know, buy a building and say, oh, by the way, my kid's applying, you know, so you're not. But this was just straight up conspiracy, racketeering, misuse of funds, lying about where the money was going. It's just, yeah, like it seems like they could have probably done something. I mean, of course, it's totally underhanded and unfair, but it's just amazing to me. Like with that, if you're making that much money, why would you do something so illegal for something that I just think is so stupid?
Yeah, it is silly, but it's also like, you know, one of the reasons is maybe because the student might not be good enough to get into these schools, right? Or also because it has become so incredibly competitive, they feel like they have to keep up with the Joneses. And I think, you know, first of all, that's sad, especially for the students who don't deserve to be at those schools. But also, you know, like you asked Casey in the beginning, did this shock you guys? And Carly, actually, I read the same article as you, the NPR article that came out yesterday, I believe. And, you know, I think the article makes a good point that this is a really good time to have a conversation about this stuff, because a lot of the disadvantages, or maybe not disadvantages, but the advantages of students who have the means that you mentioned, Carly, all those are legal, right? So, like, there are so many things already that are putting certain students at a disadvantage just because they don't have the means. And just to piggyback off yours, Carly, a couple other ones are like legacy admissions. So in the NPR article, they said that nearly half of private colleges and universities and 6% of public ones take into account whether an applicant's family member attended that school. And again, in music too, if you're like getting your brother or sister's sticks and mallets and there's instruments already in your house, you know, and things like this. But I think legacy admissions, that's a really tricky thing because the schools are trying to get more money, right? They're saying that these legacy admissions help connect the school with its alumni and their financial support. And then a couple of other ones in addition that to Carly's were the early application. So it's more likely that students are admitted if they apply early within these early decision cycles. And research shows that early options favor white and wealthy students. Yeah, so I don't know. I think it's a really good time to have this conversation of like, are we just making some of these schools off limits? And also, I love, Carly, that you brought up, related this to music, because it can help us all think about, you know, finding talent in our communities and, you know, possibly helping those students out by giving them access to university resources or teach private teachers or kind of helping them get a leg up now before, so that they can be competitive when and have a chance at having a career in the arts.
Yeah, well, also to take into an account, like when we all have students audition for us at universities, like even if they don't have the same background and experience and skills walking in the door as another student, to look for potential and to look for kind of willingness to learn. And I mean, things that I think we all know to look for that might impact a student's success way more than what they already learned in high school.
Totally.
I actually have to deal with that quite a bit here because I'm in rural Texas. So we have kids from Dallas-Fort Worth that come to audition that are, I mean, just from huge band programs with extreme, like just massive amounts of funding, private lessons all over the place. And then like one of my students from a little town down the street, I think her graduating class was like 12 people, something like that. And so obviously she didn't have those resources, and we can't just completely not serve our own community and only take in Dallas-Fort Worth students. So that's like a big battle that we fight every day here is how do we balance the small school kids with the, you know, larger school kids.
Right.
I'm just glad. I know we've talked about this on the podcast before. You know, we talk about like, why can't contemporary music, you know, get on bigger platforms, and why can't, say, jazz get on bigger platforms? And it's like, no, there's something really nice about just staying kind of where we're at. Like, it's crap like this. You don't, I mean, at least I have never heard about, you know, anything really. The art, there's just not enough to gain by getting your degree at even like Juilliard. Like, it's just no guarantee, no, you know, you can go to like the finest music school in the world and still be, you know,
not get a job,
have it not work out, you know? So I don't know. It's just kind of nice to not have to be on these huge platforms. So this guy's name who orchestrated all this was William Singer. And our guest is Jonathan Singer. Let's see how I did that. John, what do you know about
Bill?
Look, what do you know about this?
I got nothing. Mum's the word.
Nothing. Well, let me introduce John to you all. So our guest today is John Singer, and I met him, I don't know, well over 10 years ago in Boston, Massachusetts. I think John was studying at Berkeley, right? And okay, John was at Berkeley. I was at Boston Conservatory, so we were bumping into each other. And it's funny because I think I first saw him perform tabla with Nancy Zeltzman on a concert that they had put together. And I thought, oh, this guy is like a fantastic tabla player. And I talked to other people like, oh, no, John Singer, he's actually a marimbist. He's a fantastic marimbist. You got to hear him play marimba. And then all these years later, oh, no, talk to other people. He's a fantastic ragtime xylophonist. And the truth is he's really wonderful at all these things and many, many others. So he's got some great credits from like New York Times. They praise his superb formality technique that he's included in the Village Voices Best of New York. He leads a Brooklyn-based band called the Xylofolks, which if you've been on the internet at all, yeah, you know the Xylofolks, come on. And he's performed around the U.S., India, Japan, Brazil, and Canada. He teaches at the College of Staten Island and Queensbury Community College. Is that pretty much right, John?
Sorry, the bio is tough. You've got to change it every few weeks if you're, yeah.
No.
Queensborough Community College.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, that's what I meant to say. Well, anyway, it's great to have you. How are you doing?
I'm super glad to be here. And I see you guys go into the office on Sunday. You're not like buried. I'm like, this is a room that I don't spend a lot of time in because, well, I'll spare you the details, but I'm impressed by your lighting. Yeah.
Sometimes I take the call from home. You never know. It just depends.
Yeah.
I don't trust my internet at home.
Yeah, I'm not trusting this, but we'll see how it goes.
Well, really, really great to see you. What can you tell us about some upcoming projects or just like what's on the docket for you lately? I know you're putting together Xylophone Camp in June, right?
Right. So my day-to-day activity involved, I run a Facebook group called Third Floor Bazaar. So I think I packed about 30 boxes of instruments today and took them down to my car, and those will go to FedEx and the post office tomorrow. That's pretty much a constant, selling percussion instruments. And educationally, the things coming up, yeah, I just put that out today in June 17th through 21st in the Dallas area, Richmond High School. I just said that wrong. Richardson High School. I have something I'm calling Xylophone Camp because that's what it is. It's a xylophone camp.
Cool.
That's kind of geared towards college students. Last summer, was it?
That's not the first time you've done this, right? Wasn't it in Delaware before?
It was in Delaware. There was a Bob Becker, what do they call that? Xylophone Institute. And
there's
I attended that the last, I think that's the same.
That's the same. Okay.
So I attended 1 year, and afterwards, Bob had said, why don't you just take this over, more or less? So we did that in Delaware for a couple summers. One summer I did it at my graduate program, the Grad Center in Manhattan. And then last summer I was in Dallas. We were at a different school. But it's alongside a camp called Marimba Madness, which is in its maybe 19th year or something that Drew Lang came up with Chris Hanning, I think, in 2000. So that's a high school program for Dallas area students, and they get a good number of students. It's a great camp. So I said, Drew, can I come down there? And, you know, you got instruments and space and interest and do a xylophone thing. Because it's kind of hard to find a home for these camps that, you know, are in locations that make sense and have instruments. But Drew has a large collection of instruments, and he, you know, he's provided his own personal stuff, and it's great.
Can you tell us more about the bazaar? I want to know, like, it's so fun keeping an eye on the Facebook group. I learned just by paying attention to your posts. I learned about instruments I've never seen before. And I promise I'll buy something eventually. Right now, I'm just learning.
Yeah,
you know, I'm curious. I lose my mind a lot and say, like, I don't care if you buy this stuff to people. And it really, some days it feels like maybe if people stop buying the stuff, I could just do something else. It started I don't know how that started. You know, anything that I've done that's, or any of us that probably have done for any length of time, we never, I don't set out to say, I'm going to have a Facebook group that's really, you know, successful. It just sort of snuck in as to, you know, habitually what I was like buying and selling stuff on Craigslist and just not thinking about it. Just, okay, here's an estate I would, or, you know, Storage Wars and all these kinds of shows came around at the same time that I would go into like a storage unit and buy like a desk sewing machine, vibraphone, 18 drums, a Japanese guitar, and a bunch of depression glass and stuff like that.
Wow, literally.
And then fill a U-Haul with it or a van, and then come home and fill our apartment and try to sell this stuff. So that's how it started. And then I learned, about vintage drums I was dealing with. And now it seems that everybody's buying and selling anything. I mean, not just percussion, but I really started with vacuums because I thought, one, everybody can relate to a vacuum, and most people don't think of the resale market of like high-end vacuums. So that was one, an easy way to talk to like people in general, and also profitable because people would move overseas with like a $1,400 vacuum with, you know, and they couldn't use it anymore. So I'd say, okay, I guess I'll sell this thing. Nobody wants to use vacuum, right? Here, take it for nothing. And it turns out people do. And so that just kind of transferred to percussion.
I saw someone selling a car on your page once.
Right.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to.
Right.
The Timpani and Percussion Swap Shop is the group on Facebook that has, I don't know, over 10,000, you know, followers. And that's where people buy and sell percussion instruments. And I was posting so much that they asked me to stop. It's just like, and create your own group. So a few years ago, I did that. And so I just said, this is just my stuff. You can't sell your stuff here because right. then, you know, there'd be another Timpani percussion swap shop. But the cars, the junk cars from Ohio are hilarious. And then, you know, there's sort of a culture of people picking on me for details because as if I have all this time to make you a sound file just because you wanted to hear that instrument, you're not going to buy it. You know, right. So they'll jump on these poor guys selling a hoopty out of you know, the suburbs of Akron, and these guys don't know what hit them. So it's amusing. Yeah,
it's just great because the comments that followed that were like, yeah, I need a sound sample of that car, like telling them like, hey, this is not what you're supposed to be doing here. Like, this is not what this page is for, you know, kind of self-regulates, you know. Yeah,
this is so funny. Has anyone ever claimed an item on any of these pages as like a stolen item that's being sold? Have you ever had to deal with any like scandals with that?
A couple times I've actually been able to help people find somebody bought some xylophone bars that looked like they were being scammed. So I went ahead and messaged that person, and it turns out they're selling the same item to multiple people, and it ended up okay. They honored the original agreement and backed out of the other fraudulent ones. But that's the kind of thing that happens all the time. And there's sort of a network of folks who have an eye on, you know, oh, so-and-so teaches at this school, so-and-so committed credit card fraud 3 years ago, and you know, we know that it's out there. You know, you want to be able to call people out, but at the same time, you never know the circumstance, so you don't do that. But it's an unspoken thing, and at least in like the small network of folks who are selling, buying, and selling stuff, we know what's up.
When it's so small, you're gonna, the word's gonna spread really quick and easily. I would think.
Yeah.
I get really involved with the story of it. That's the problem. Instead of just saying like, okay, this person, you know, is fraudulent, is listing their school's gear. It's clear because they don't even teach at the school. Their kids' school's gear, you know. And then you find the videos, and they send me a video of a kid in the marching uniform so I can make out the name of the school and everything. And then I'm just like, okay, this guy's going to jail. And it's, you lose sleep over, it's not really worth it. But I do kind of love that stuff.
You must get a kick out of this stuff, right? Because if you were really annoyed by it, you wouldn't do it.
Well, it breaks up the, you know, I saw 12 gongs and I put them in boxes. That's what it is. But here I have some story of communication. There's three people sent him money, you know, PayPal, friends and family. So PayPal won't honor a refund on that. And what I found most of the scams and most of this kind of stuff is about short-term loan, like no interest loans. And you can kind of play any of these PayPal or whatever, Venmo or whatever. You're going to get, it's going to take a month for them to straighten it out. So if you need money quick, you can probably scam people. It's just nuts when it involves a marimba, you know?
I got scammed by Amazon this year. I didn't tell you guys about this. I should do a podcast segment on this. Maybe I will prepare that.
Well, you got scammed by a Amazon user through Amazon, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they just sent me like a bunch of bogus stuff. There were like some of those silicone baking sheets, which is nice, but there's also this book that just had horrendous grammar. I don't remember the name of the book. I should have taken a picture of it. I ended up just recycling it. But it was bizarre book. And
what were you trying to buy?
I wasn't trying to buy anything. It just got sent to my house in a box, and it's got an Amazon. Like, I didn't order anything from Amazon. What's up with this? It was just like in January. And then there are three, coincidentally, there was like a $297 charge on my credit card account. And I was like, what is this? And then I got this box of stuff. And so I reported it. And what I should have done probably is ship the stuff back, but I just like got rid of it. Cause I was like, what the heck is this? And so then the credit card company said, yeah, this is a scam. They removed the charge. And then just this month, that same charge came back and it still said January. And I was like, wait, what? This happened again? Or what's going on? So I called the credit card company and they said, oh yeah, we, you know, went through with a review of this. And turns out they're like, yeah, you purchased these things. I was like, and they like listed the items. I was like, what? I did not purchase these things. And so they said, okay, well, if you didn't purchase these things, we can have it reviewed again, but you probably won't hear from us for like 30 days. I was like, okay. So the charge is going to sit on my account for them. And so they're like, well, what you can do is try to contact Amazon to get a letter that says that you didn't buy these things. So it's not like in my orders, you know, there's no proof of it. And so I went on Amazon. I could not figure out how to contact Amazon. I mean, I must have spent like an hour going through drop down menus and just trying to figure out how I could contact someone to try to get a letter, and I couldn't figure it out. So then I was like, well, I'll just wait the 30 days. And then that, in the meantime, I just like put a line item in my budget. Like, okay, I got scammed by Amazon, $300 that cost me this month. And I just kind of gave up on it. I was like, it's just not worth my time. And then I got a letter in the mail that said, we reviewed it again. And like, we have, so that we will take the charge off your account. So
good.
Hopefully it's good. But I was just like, what? This is so crazy. And if there's a specific name for it, I don't know what it is. Like I said, maybe I'll prepare I learned some interesting things about Amazon scams when I was trying to figure out what to do about this. So
I've wanted to do it for so long. I prank called one of the phone scammers. I highly recommend it. It's really satisfying. And I don't think it causes problems. I don't get any more calls than I used to. People will say, oh, but then they're gonna send you, put your number on the big list, and then you're gonna get tons of scam call. No, it's no different. I still get the same amount.
Yeah,
but it's really fun. I felt like I was 15 years old all over again making a prank call. Really
good. Did you record it?
No, I think next time I will, though, because it's a big, it's like really, they're kind of fun to listen to on the internet. People
go do that next episode.
Right, we could do it live.
Mm-hmm. That would be fun. You should do that.
We do have, well, once I figured out the serious part of the question, our buddy Matt Henry asked John, he says, congrats on the PASIC clinic last year, and would like to know, what are your thoughts on changing the education system so we get students on their desired path much earlier in life? Maybe that had something to do with your clinic? Or is it separate?
Maybe. maybe. I don't, yeah, my clinic was as most of the things I'm involved with, I call a mess, which is how I operate. It's always a mess. And so I probably talked about coming into, yeah, I know I did. I talked about my early introduction to xylophone and to marimba music as a child. You know, I was 13 and went to the Lee Stevens competition in Asbury Park and heard all this collegiate marimba music. and so I think Matthew probably read into that as the, being my desired path. Which it was at the time. Though the thing about that is, I think I burned out by the time I got to college. So I don't know if I teach at these places in my bio, but I don't teach percussion. I teach percussion in the summer or master classes, but I should say that I don't have experience, you know, teaching a percussion studio or lessons like that kind of thing. So most of my students are going to be nurses and cops and. Probably percussion students are also going to be nurses.
So are you teaching like music appreciation or something?
Yeah, musicianship at the community college. It's like associate stuff. Kids who, you know, they like music and they want an introduction to college and to those courses. But so I shouldn't answer this question as if I have given a lot of thought, but or the experience dealing with that. So thinking about this question without a lot of experience teaching undergraduate percussion, for example, I would imagine having a lot of freedom to do what you wish, because that's how, you know, as a kid, I was just able to do whatever I wanted and not being told that I need to go this direction or that direction. And so you only do what you desire. and that's been my whole life in a way. I've gone to college programs that didn't have a trajectory, that were sort of self-directed. And comments, I think, on some of my recitals while I was in school were, wow, this is unlike any other school program because, you know, who's your teacher? Well, I like this, I like that. So I think that's it, just keeping out of the way. If students are into stuff, if you're not into it, then I don't know. That's a different job, is to inspire and give direction. But I was pretty much always self-directed and inspired by, you know, stuff that I sought out.
Well, does anyone else? I feel like we could all kind of speak to that question. I mean, it's so general. What are your thoughts on the educational system so we get students on their desired path earlier? Okay. And I don't know if that's. I mean, the problem I see is students have, hey, it's Julia Gaines. I see her. She's trying to run by. Julia Gaines.
I'm sorry.
Oh, it's fun. She could answer this question. Hey.
Hi, I just need a piece of music. Sorry.
Can you believe we're still doing this?
No, it's fantastic.
It's cool. Can you believe Megan still does this with us?
Yes, I can. I know she's here every week. She's very faithful. Sorry, my bad.
Good to see you. But, you know, I mean, the problem I've seen is I meet students who, you know, they're in music, but they're not really in it. You know, I think we've all seen that type of student at various levels, even all the way up through college, you know, like, well, this was kind of the thing I was best at, but they don't really have that, you know, what Angela Duckworth calls the grit for it. And like we were just talking about when we opened up the episode, and it's all so competitive. If you don't have that, you really, it doesn't matter what school you go to, you won't, do well, you know?
Well, I think one of the things we have to do as teachers is help students find what makes them special, what sets them apart, and what they're like particularly motivated about, and then strengthening that and encouraging that, in addition to, you know, not neglecting the other areas of percussion that they might be less excited about. But that's one part that I think is tough, because, you know, only a student can find that. And sometimes it can take, you know, a lifetime to figure out what the thing is that you have to offer that nobody else does.
I don't know if you remember when Homer Simpson graduated high school. He was with his guidance counselor, and his guidance counselor said, "Homer, have you thought about what you're going to do when you graduate?" And he said, "Yeah, I'm going to drink a lot of beer and stay up all night." Like, that's literally like all he wanted to do. I feel like it's hard when they don't, like, that might literally be what some people, like, all they want to do, you know?
It's what a lot of people do, whether they want to or don't.
Right. So I mean, to Matt's question, like, do you find this, is it that they can't find their, is it that you can't get them on the path soon enough, or is it that they don't know what their path would be, you know? I don't know.
The odds are pretty low, right? How you got, between the four of you, you have a lot of students.
Right.
The odds that everyone's going to be on their desired path. That sounds like a, the odds that the right thing to do is go study music, not in your favor, I don't think.
No. But like, it should be so simple. Like, if that's not the thing you want to do, then you wouldn't be doing that. But that's what I mean. That's what I'm saying. It's really mysterious, because, like, why are they doing that then? You know, if that's not their desired path, then why are the odds this bad? You know, and that's what I'm saying. I think all they want to, like, some people, they literally don't have a passion. They just want to, like, drink beer and play Fortnite.
It's hard. I just figured out I want to, like, learn some tunes. So I'm now, that's what I do. Sorry, I should talk about my xylophone in the kitchen for 3 seconds, which is just, I play xylophone in my kitchen because that's like, where else are you going to do that? And so I've spent lots of years thinking, I can't do this. I'd like to, I can't do that. It's like, wait a second. I just didn't have a natural affinity to fall into it. So I do these things where I take 10 episodes now and, like, really try to work on something, and then think about it 10 episodes later. Like, okay, was this anything? And most of the time, by the third, you know, hour, I'm thinking about it. It's exciting. But now people would expect that I'm able to do this stuff already at this point in my life. You know, not many people are playing trying to learn tunes on xylophone. Like, nobody, actually. So there's no precedent for it. And that means it's all on me. And they'd say, I'm passionate about this, I want to do this thing. No, but waddle around in it. You figure that out. And students, yeah, today, Instagram Nation, I don't know, people are, like, so glued to their device that I think we're not, you know, able to think about the next move. You're just scrolling.
Yeah, maybe so.
I was trying to think.
Want to buy some crotales? I got a deal on Sabian Octave crotales. Swipe to the, yeah.
How good is the deal?
You tell me. Free shipping, and it will do too good to even. They'll be sold by the time you edit this thing, and yeah.
Yeah, this will be a ways. Ben, I think you're going to say something.
Yeah, well, I was trying to, like, think of something meaningful to add to this discussion, because it's
that's what I was, like, trying so those, hard to do.
Yeah, it's one of those questions. It's like, of course, like, that's, like, a legitimate concern, but it's also like, how do you tackle that? But I had a really interesting conversation here. So we just had our jazz festival at Tarleton this past weekend, and we had Ari Honig as a guest artist, who's just a monster drummer, played in the 1 o'clock at UNT and is on the scene in New York. And Ari was talking about how far jazz education has come in the past, like, 30 years or so. And he said it's kind of problematic, like, how good jazz education has gotten. Because now I can give you a book and it has, quote unquote, everything you need to know about jazz. And it sort of does, but also, like, it sort of ignores the sort of, you know, almost 100-year-old, like, oral tradition and listening to this stuff. And yeah, like, if you want to learn about jazz, you don't open up a textbook, you go buy a Miles Davis record, right? And so I think we have this system where a lot of students are very good at music and have had very good educational foundations to get good at music. But it's like not, I guess not, yeah, like what Casey's talking about, not their passion. Is that, am I making sense here? So yeah. I think it's like a large portion of this is like seeing the bigger picture and seeing outside of the textbooks. And like Megan has talked about a lot before, like, yeah, so you can play a paradiddle on the snare drum, but how does that relate to the world at large and like culture at large and all these like much bigger questions than like what's the best sticking to play for this passage in key G or whatever? So I don't know. Hopefully that what I just said made sense and got somewhere in the discussion. But yeah, it's so much bigger, I think, than it, I think the issue is so much bigger than we realize, really.
I think we should send Matt Henry a nasty email for taking up 10 minutes of... burning up 10 minutes of podcast
time. Would have been better if he just added to the list of other nonsensical comments.
Yeah. You know, how you play with those but I heard, Matt,
I know. Matt, I should have just asked the joke portion. I heard actually
market for some Cretales if you want to get in touch.
I'll just read the joke portions from now on. Hey, well, there is... Carly, I think you have another question. Let's see if it does as much damage as Matt's.
I do. This one is from Jacob Garcia. And he says, we see percussionists of all levels study ragtime music nowadays, middle school aged through professionals. When do you think is a good time for someone to dive in? And how would you encourage someone who is unfamiliar to approach this style?
There is no time like the present. I guess one of my beefs is that, that xylophone is somehow pinned as this ragtime instrument. People say, oh, you play ragtime or you play anything else, I guess. It's like, we have ragtime and everything else. So, and it's a really bizarre thing that students get introduced to xylophone and marimba, you know, accompaniment and percussion ensemble is this thing that we do. It's just like yet another thing on the very long checklist of things to do. And, you know, and I'm just like everybody else introduced to that. I thought it was a thing. I heard it on a percussion ensemble concert, loved that music, and got, you know, deeper into it. It's not like I heard it on a concert of 1920s and 30s music, and it was just happened to be, oh, that's the xylophone in this larger context. But really what I have been trying to pitch to schools and in my own teaching is a larger picture of what was happening in, Ben mentioned, you know, jazz being 100 years old. So we give the original Dixieland Jazz Band credit in 1917 for the first jazz record. And so there's all this music happening around then. And George Hamilton Green's recording in 1917, novelty music, and then gets labeled jazz and all this stuff. So I would hope that people could somehow, and it's me bringing it into it because I don't know if other folks are, if there's anybody out there, get in touch, because I'd love to be a party of more than one. There are people brought in the context of popular music from the early part of the 20th century, and kind of like as a kind of a recovering Berkeley student where I tried to study jazz, I wish that the curriculum started at the beginning rather than, okay, I heard Gary Burton play 20 million things. Let's try to figure this out. It's like, I don't even know what a C major 7 chord or a C6 chord is, you know? So to answer Jacob's question, you can start anytime. and how to get into it, I would plug into the musical scene rather than just the percussive aspect of it. Try to look at early jazz or you know, that's what broadens one's view instead of, okay, I need to know what kind of mallets and what kind of sticking and, you know, the music look at, and it's intimidating to like a middle school student. Somebody lays on you Paul Whiteman record and you don't know any of the instruments. You don't know why it sounds like, you know, you don't know what a 78 is. You don't have one of these, you know, this is a arm of a patrol here. Yeah, just dive in, and the resources are out there. One great one for xylophone is the Xylophone and Marimba History Group that David Harvey runs on Facebook. And there's just, all the geeks are there. We're all, like, way too excited to share anything and everything. So that would be a great starting place.
Well, speaking of sharing, we talk about your upcoming Xylofolks EP.
Yes.
Okay. I can. You went on the website. It's not a functional website. Upcoming Xylofolks EP. What do you mean?
It says on your website that you have a EP.
2009.
Oh, nine. Oh my gosh, not 19. That's okay. Sorry.
I am excited in a couple of weeks to do a Tiny Desk submission. And so my in 2009 we also did what was called the Five Borough Bodega Tour. Bodegas are like corner stores in New York City.
Oh, neat.
And so we went to the five boroughs, you know, Staten Island, Manhattan, Queens, Brooklyn, the Bronx. I think we did it in a day and played in convenience stores. And that was the most fun I think I had shooting a project like that. And I so now it's like a decade later, I want to play in places with desks. And so we'll do like 10 seconds at different, you know, tech companies or try to go into Staples and see if we can stay out of jail and play behind different
desks. And then that's going to be your Tiny Desk submission.
Yes. Yeah.
That's nice.
And there's no way we'll get it or anything, but I just want an excuse to like have fun.
Don't
and,
say that.
Yeah.
You guys are totally going to get it. And like, what is the status of Xylofolks? I mean, you guys play together regularly still, or?
So I expanded the group to be a 10-piece group, which means I have to do a ton of arranging. And we were playing like monthly at a bar in Brooklyn. We have a 2-year-old now, so I try not to play out at night too much. you know, Xylofolks in its heyday, we would be doing everything at every hour anywhere, and playing a lot on the subway platforms. So that's a group I should really record with the group, and we play, and you know, stuff happens. I've been trying to incorporate that repertoire into the school clinics, and next week I'll be at NYU. I'm trying to get the students to play, what do you call that, mixed instrumentation as opposed to percussion ensemble. Say like, okay, I know nobody plays C melody saxophone, which, you know, production has stopped on C melody saxophones in 1930. So it's not a common instrument, but wouldn't it be cool if we could find a saxophonist who would work with somebody in town that I play with? And it can't be that difficult to take that up. And you'd be the one person in town who was into that. And can we get a pianist interested in checking out, you know, what it would be like to play these charts as opposed to just reading arrangements that have been done that we buy? Yeah.
Interesting. Cool.
Ben, did you have something?
Yo, I had a question. Maybe about a year ago, there was a guy, I think his name is Paul Fadul, that put out a recording of Nagoya Marimbas, and he played both parts himself. And I don't know if he said or someone said, but it came up like, oh, this is the first guy I'd ever played Nagoya Marimbas by himself. And then someone said, no, John Singer did that already. So
John Singer did John, that when he was 5.
Yeah, is that true? And did you do it with, I think I heard you did it with 2 mallets, which sounds crazy. Casey and I could barely play it with 2 people. So could you tell us about playing the Nagoya Marimbas all by yourself?
Here, I'll send you a link so when you're sick of listening to me talk, you can watch this and mute me. Yeah, so I'll send it when we're off. That was a bet. I started school in...
It wasn't that...
New York.
And it sounds like, hey, do you want to take this not that hard piece and make it way hard?
Why did I think that was a good idea? I mean, it's possible, right? Like, other than the last chord has 3 notes. Otherwise, I never really understood this 2-mallet, 4-mallet thing. Like, I just don't understand why people, oh, you're a 2-mallet player. It's like, I guess, I don't know. I'm holding 2 now. So that seemed like natural to me to try to play that. If you have 2 voices, use 2 mallets. Let's see. That started out, yeah, I moved to New York and went to Juilliard for a very short time. And there was a percussionist there, Jeff Irving. And I don't know if he bet me or I think I was just like, hey, I think I could do this myself. And he's like, I'll give you $100 if you can do that. And if you're a freshman, $100, like... a lot of money, I guess. So I tried it and I failed miserably. After I don't think I tried very hard. And then when I was doing DMA, you know what it's like. You all have DMAs and you sit in these seminars where you're with a bunch of like musicians who can play Schubert and all this stuff that's regarded as, you know, great music. And then it comes to the percussionist in the room. And I was like, I don't know. You guys don't know any of the music that I play and whatever I do well. Steve Reich should come up in conversation with somebody at some point. And I said, well, why don't I just do this? Actually, all the music I played during my DMA, I think, was because of these kind of funny conversations where there's like a silence in the room and like, well, I'll do that next week. So I was in a course with Tanya Leon, who was like, oh, this is salsa music. Steve Reich's music is dance music. You know, you got to find the cascara and all this stuff. It was fun. So that's the story with that. And also it was because I'd gone to so many of these clinics and master classes where the thing was always the performer comes in or the person comes in and performs something. So everybody in the room knows how great they are. And then there's like a weird, like, I guess now the students will play and not be as great. And then that's how that format tends to work, or at least did in the like 90s. So I was like, I need one of those pieces to just like shame everybody. So this will be good because the mallets go all over the place. And I was never happy doing that because it's stressful and you miss all the notes. And there's like a thing about Reich's music that it's good to like play it accurately with the pitches. But people forgive you. They say, oh, that's so challenging. Paul did a great job. You know, he really worked it up. And I think he had probably more organization to his approach in practicing it, whereas I was just like, I gotta play this thing. Yeah.
Do you find percussionists are into seeing it? Do you think they, at least percussionists who know the duo, can appreciate it?
That's it. When I program it for non percussion crowds, they're just like, oh, it's kind of a repetitive piece. I think it doesn't work because, and I did this a couple weeks ago. I played at a school in Arkansas, and I played this Paganini Caprice that I'd worked on, and it's pretty impressive, but the teacher said, do you want to play the students Itzhak Perlman playing this so they can see like what you're up against first? And I was like, no, it should kind of speak for itself, and if it looks easy, then who cares? It looks easy. Yeah, always when I played that, somebody speaks up either after the concert or before and says, oh, this is actually a duet, like, you know. One of the fun things I did at ZMF, and I remember a couple people were like, oh, where's the second player? And then when the second, you know, when they kind of realize, you hear like a little gasp in the audience.
Right.
That's fun, but that's distracting too. So
did you write out both parts as one, or how? How'd you get there?
Yeah, I put the second part, I laid them out on the same thing.
Gotcha.
I don't recommend doing this. There's a lot of like problems in the world. Go deal with that. this is like if you have time to kill in a class. And I don't, you know, percussionists are the only ones who are like, could you play that for us? And it's always in a masterclass situation where I'll be really into something and they'll say, hey, I saw this video of you. And I kind of stumble through it for a minute and they all like kind of sheepishly applaud and we move on.
Oh, fun. It's cool. Well, you guys, I do have a sound for you today. John, we play this little game called What's the Sound? And it's not very fun at all, but I'll give you guys a hint today. Hint is friction roll, like tambourine friction roll, like we sometimes have to do.
So no, I don't know what it is, but I always have something on my desk that I fidget with. And this whole episode, I've been fidgeting with the Super Bowl mallet, and like
you need makes to pay the exact same sound
across my desk.
That's the sound.
It is. So, it's Super Bowl.
Does sound like a Super Bowl mallet, bass drum, Super Bowl mallet, bass drum.
So this is kind of what it sounds like. But this sound is so loud that apparently the accounts of it that when it when you experience it, you will have to shout to over to be heard over the sound. And this is caused by sand dunes, and it happens in every major desert around the world. And it's been reported by explorers throughout history, Marco Polo, even Charles Darwin. They talk about what they call singing, thanks, John, they call singing dunes or singing sands or the booming sands. So what's happening is the wind blows and you have, you know, it's sand. I don't know anything about sand dunes. I'm just reporting what I read. So you have the colder layer of sand that's solid and hard. And then you have the top layer that's been hit by the sun all day and it's really loose and it will simply slide. And when it slides, it causes friction. And big sand dunes can get something like 750 feet high. I think the highest recorded one was like 1,200 feet high. So as long as the slope is 30 degrees or steeper, if you get the right little avalanche, it can last as long as 5 minutes. The sand will slide and the friction causes the sound, but also there's not much of that sliding layer. That sliding layer is pretty thin and it creates a resonant body against the cold portion of the sand, and it creates this very cacophonous loud humming. And of course there have been, you know, myths and legends and talking and lots of cool speculations as to, you know, of course what it is, and lots of lore as to what it is, but it's just the friction of the sands. And they didn't figure it out until fairly recently, actually. And let's see. Yeah, it's fairly new that they really figured it out. So people thought for years, oh, it was just the wind going over the peak of the sand and that's creating this hum. But one explorer named Ralph Alger Bangnold, he says, I've heard it in the southwestern Egypt, 300 miles from the nearest habitation. On two occasions, it happened on a still night, suddenly a vibrant booming so loud that I had to shout to be heard by my companion. Soon, other sources, set going by the disturbance, joined their music to the first with so close a note that a slow beat was clearly recognized. So I guess the drone can be low enough that they'll hear pulses. And I read somewhere that it's always a F, a E, or a G, so G, F, E is always the pitch. This weird chorus went on for more than 5 minutes continuously. Native tales have woven it into fantasies. Sometimes it is the song of the sirens to lure travelers into their waterless doom. Sometimes it is said to come upwards from bells still tolling underground in a sand engulfed monastery. So I don't know, cool little thing I just bumped into. And I don't know, hopefully it's like when you're explaining a finger roll, it's really, that'd be really helpful. A friction roll.
That's super cool. Yeah, I feel like there's some movies where we've seen this, like an Indiana Jones movie or something where, you know.
Maybe.
I'm not really sure.
That could be. So, yeah, they also talk about squeaky sand. So we've all probably experienced this. You're walking on a beach and it's like white sand and your feet make little squeaks. And also if you just rub your hand fast against the sand, you'll hear this little squeak. So they also talk about they thought for a long time that sand dunes were just doing that. And because there was so much of it, it was just the sand on sand friction, like really fine sand does, quartz sand. But these sand dunes are a much more mix of minerals and soils, that it's the friction of the loose against the hard, and it's just so much surface area that it makes it way, way, way loud. So anyway, that's your sound for the day. Hard to guess, I think.
How'd you come up with that, Casey?
I hunt for these like crazy. That's how I do it. I just hope the internet will provide them. Sometimes they get handed to me. Like someone posts something, go like, oh, that's neat, I'll try to figure out what the heck that is. But yeah, sometimes I have to just hunt for them because it's a podcast. We got to do our homework, Megan.
Yeah.
Megan, did you have a question for John to kind of finish us out?
Yeah, sure. John, I was curious of your experience in India and your Fulbright experience with the Fulbright program. And, you know, I know that you've incorporated tabla into your music making here in the United States, but I'm just curious of, you know, how you originally got interested in it, but especially what your experience was like studying there.
actually got a Fulbright to study South Indian music, mridangam. I studied tabla here as well, but when I went to India, it was to specifically study the accompaniment of South Indian vocal music, which is something like right now, South Indian percussion has kind of gone gangbusters because of Instagram and Facebook and people kind of choreographing konakal, vocal percussion, to marching percussion and all sorts of things, yeah. Calculations. So it's very popular. But what I wanted to get into was playing for the music. Kind of, I guess that's in common with the you know, ragtime thing too. It's like I wanted to get into a musical setting with it. And that was depressing because it turns out if you don't grow up with that music, you know, you have a quick grasp on a lot of it, and a lot of things would just feel like they wouldn't come if I spent a decade there. And, you know, it was, after 3 months, I had daily lessons, which were pretty much all day. I was fortunate to, I knew my teacher for some years before, and he was very, very dedicated. So it was a great, you know, match in that way. And we're still, you know, in touch. After a few months, when the vocalist came every couple days, I said, okay, what song is this? And it was the same song we were playing. And like, I don't hear any of this. And he's like, you know what? And I'd go to concerts and there'd be, you know, called Rasikas, people who just soak up the music, fans, or it's not more than a fan. It's somebody who's part of the musical community. And they would, you know, somebody would sing three notes and they say, oh, you know, in 1968, somebody at the hall down the street sang this and here were the musicians. Like, I'm never going to understand, you know, not 1% of this. And it just didn't feel right after a while. So I kind of had a great experience with Fulbright as far as the actual administration of the grant and the trip. But after that point, I just went on sort of trying to experience India and study different instruments, which is not easy to do if you have one guru or teacher. You're not free to, you know, roam all over the place necessarily. And I was doing all sorts of social faux pas and all that. And then I brought the xylophones and we toured. And by that time, I was already kind of burnt. But I was there, you know, 8 months or something. And I think it would have been wiser to go, you can't do it through Fulbright, but other grants where you go 3 months, 2 months, shorter periods, and then come back and digest. And uh-huh. You know, yeah, but I didn't have a end goal in mind. And you can't, if you're going to just take up music, you can't, oh, I want to do a concert. What's that going to sound like, a three-year-old playing a concert? Yeah. So, yeah.
Right. Wow. That's interesting. Yeah. And I don't know. It's such a, I think that experience though is valuable for other people looking to do that. Because I think, I don't know, a lot of times I see a lot of people be like, oh yeah, I want to go to India and study tabla, or yeah, I want to go to Ghana and learn, you know, West African lead drumming. And it's like, I mean, I think sometimes students don't realize like how deep this music is, and you know, it's a different learning style, and that it's a big commitment. You know, it's not something you can like tread lightly and really and or master a period. So
I'll say this is that, and what I encourage anybody to do that, to travel, so that you can feel that there are two ways to live. You know, we live here, or you're sort of a, what do we say, natural habitat. And then you go outside yourself and you visit someplace as an outsider or trying to assimilate or not, however you do it. That experience is something that definitely I wouldn't trade for, you know, that's what you take away from it. And you bring back and see, oh, there's any number of ways to do something, but certainly two ways where if you think you're the greatest, this or that, you're a nobody just down the block, you know?
Right. And in a big way, I mean, that's what Fulbright encourages, right? Is just exploration and, you know, cultural exchange and living in another culture, not necessarily. I had a lot of friends when I was living in Jordan who were on Fulbrights, and I was kind of shocked at how loose the guidelines, but how loose the program was. And but I totally get why, you know, and, you know, hopefully it'll get too many people who just, you know, screw around for the time that they're there, but really take advantage of, you know, living in another place and being immersed in another culture. But I think that's why it is that way. You know, they don't need you to play a 90-minute recital in India or, you know, whatever. It's a little bit looser guidelines.
So given that it is so loose, what do y'all think is the, like, how competitive are Fulbrights? I've never even looked at them.
Super competitive.
Okay.
Super duper
competitive. It depends on the, you can look at the, I don't, they used to have it on the site, you know, which countries have how many. The year that I went was the first year that it was partnered with the Indian government. So I think they doubled for India. But it also depends. It started out as a language fellowship where you're going someplace to study the language. But in India, you can, like, I studied Tamil for a little bit, but after a while, it's like, we're going to speak English with you. And, you know, India has a lot of appeal because you can be an English speaker, and similar Ghana and different countries have more appeal than others where you definitely can't get by without speaking the language. So yeah, I think it's fair. I have a friend who applied for Ghana like many times, and finally, and now she's in Kuwait actually, and didn't get it. I was on an alternate or something, and you find out that there's all these funny things about having affiliate, an host institution. So, and they have to, if you pick the right place, then that might look better. Saying like, okay, this institution has experience with Fulbrighters coming through, as opposed to, oh, I have this renowned teacher at some place you've never heard of, and they're going to take you for a ride, and you're not going to, you know, the main thing is don't get sick the first few months or first few weeks rather, because they want to know that you're not just going to waste the plane ticket. I think that's kind of what I got. So if you can hang, like, you know, Megan, what you were saying is accurate. Like, for me, after 3 months, it was like, well, my whole application now and proposal is out the window, because I've learned that's just, I was in the sky thinking, oh, I'm going to play for songs. No, that's going to take 6-7 years to have a rudimentary, you know, level of that. It's the same thing. And that's why they laughed. You know, a lot of the host institutions laughed at the idea of coming for 9 months. They said, no, this is an 8-year program. Or India, it's a 30-year process to sort of learn the music. And that's to a Westerner who's like, oh, I got a semester. That's a little jarring. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think also, yeah, I've looked into applying for these for several times. And like, Casey, if you're trying to go somewhere in Europe, yeah, I mean, they do still have the map, John. I was helping a student with this, but there's a map on the Fulbright website of how many awards they have for and for which countries. And so, like, Europe is highly competitive. English speaking countries are typically highly competitive. But, you know, even if there are smaller grants, for example, for French speaking countries in Africa, there might be smaller number of grants, but less people apply for them because you have to have French proficiency or something like that, you know? So it just depends.
Well, great. Well, man, we should kind of wrap up here. I did prepare a quiz for you all, but I think I'm just going to ask one question. Carly actually had to go. She had a concert to run to, so thanks, Carly. But I just have one question. So, yeah, John, we play this little game that's review trivia from the previous episodes. It's also not fun, but...
nothing we do is fun.
Did you learn this from Nancy's marimba party?
The quiz?
No, this idea of fun things that aren't fun. It's like, it's a marimba party. Now let's just cut each other.
Yeah. Oh, I get it. No, I blocked all that out.
Oh, good. Good.
I always liked marimba party. I thought, like, wow, I feel so included and fancy. And I'm a percussion major, but I'm invited to marimba party. Yeah, no, with the big marimba majors. It's pretty cool. Well, anyway, this metronome makes you feel like you're on a game show. So, okay, here's your just one question for the day. Back on episode 134, Laurel reported on some recent research by a Dr. Anthony Holland, and that's actually a DMA, not an MD. And this research was on blasting cancer cells by finding their resonant frequencies It involved two frequencies. You find the base resonant frequency of the cancer cell, and then apparently he found that microorganisms begin to shatter at the 11th harmonic. So when those two frequencies are together, the cancer cells are obliterated. So in the 1880s, this is an older, much older idea, in the 1880s, they had the same, gave the same thing a try, and a French composer and acupuncturist named Fabien Mamon, along with a biologist, Helen Clément, shattered uterine cells using what instrument? This is a tough one.
I remember talking about this, but I don't know.
This is very little detail.
Using a musical instrument?
Yeah.
Oh my God, I don't remember.
It's a xylophone.
Oh, I should have known that. We have. Gosh.
Happy New Year. Yes.
No, it's so hard to remember. I mean, I hunt for these questions. Otherwise, I wouldn't remember details like that.
That is so weird. What you guys just did is so weird.
The quiz.
Yeah, that is so weird.
No, it's good. We do this all the time.
I listen to your podcast while driving, and I think that's like, I would like, it's not safe to drive when that's happening.
The quiz is too intense. Yeah.
So real quick, speaking of percussion trivia, I was thinking about preparing a segment for today because we're talking about John and xylophone and stuff, but I didn't because I already did it. So if you want to review your info about the Green Brothers, episode 11 with Sean Tilburg, I did a little Green Brothers segment.
Nice.
That's not how it works, Ben. You have to do the segment on the actual episode.
I did, just like almost 200 episodes ago.
I know. It's funny. There have been a couple times I'd be like, oh, yeah, I should do something on this. And I'm like, I go back and check every time now. I still have like my notes, you know, of everything. Just to make sure.
Ugh, it's hard.
Casey,
yeah.
Quizmaster, here's a question for you. What famous movie did the Green Brothers do the sound effects for, Casey?
Do they do the sound effects for? No, I'm just kidding. I know that's Emil Richards. Yeah.
I don't Unbelievable.
Know. I have no idea.
John, do you know?
I was going to say Steamboat.
Steamboat Willie.
Willie.
Is Steamboat Willie really?
I don't know.
Willie,
is that the actual? Yeah. Anyway,
there was a problem with that question. Is that a movie?
Yeah.
Steamboat Willie?
Yeah.
Oh, is it?
1928. Okay. I got paid $600. Yeah, everybody knows this.
I guess I was thinking of Mickey on the Steamboat.
That's it.
That's it. Yeah, it's not a movie. It's like a cartoon.
Whatever. It's a cartoon. Yeah, yeah.
It's like a the short Shining. Cartoon.
The Shining was the answer.
All right. Hey, you guys, thanks a lot. John, thanks a bunch. It's good to see you.
Thank you. This was
Thank
fun.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Cool. All right. Bye, everybody. Thanks a lot.
Bye.